Welcome to UFO Think Tank Radio with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Thank you for that lovely introduction, computer lady. Would that be neat if I had like this robotic engineer working my show? That would really be very cool. That's the illusion that I am trying to make you believe with that robotic voice. But unfortunately, that is not the case. Although artificial intelligence continues to astound us. What was the game? Oh, I was watching a show where it was the Alex Trebek show. What is that one where you have to ask the question? Jeez. I can't believe I can't remember the name of this. Anyway, it was this game show. They're beating us at chess. They're beating us at all of these game shows. I mean, what's going on here? AI will be taking over. Regardless, hello, everyone, and welcome to UFO Think Tank Radio. I am Alejandro Rojas, and we have a wonderful show for you today. Our guest is Randy Nickerson. He is working on a documentary that he is doing in conjunction with the John Mack Foundation. Yes, that is the John Mack, who was a Harvard professor of psychology, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, T.E. Lawrence, he wrote about, interesting enough. And so this was, you know, a respected gentleman in his field who started getting involved with the paranormal and abduction phenomena in particular, actually brought into the field by Bud Hopkins, our good friend. Anyway, what happened is John Mack was invited to look at this incredible case in Ruwa, Zimbabwe, at the Ariel School, where a bunch of children had claimed, I mean, tens of dozens of children who had claimed to have seen a craft land in the schoolyard, and these two entities come out and one of them moved towards them. And very interesting. So some of you have probably seen some of these interviews. If you have not, then Google this. Go to YouTube. Trust me. Very, very interesting to see these children. And John Mack, being a psychologist, was worked with children. And he just does a wonderful job interviewing these children and drawing out, you know, the information about what they had seen. And you can tell, you know, in the way that these children speak, that they're very genuine. I think they come across as very honest. They're very young, 8 to 12 years old. And so it's an amazing case. Since then, Randy Nickerson, working on this project, has gone back and interviewed these children who are now in their 20s to see if their stories remain the same. And he says, yes. They do, that these kids are not backing down. This is what they saw. So it's a terribly interesting case. His what Randy Nickerson has found by revisiting this case, I think, is very significant. And so we'll have him on the show to talk about this. And I cannot wait till this documentary comes out. So I've been waiting for a while for this thing. And so it's great to be able to catch up with Randy and to find out, hey, when's this thing coming out, buddy? I want to see it, and so do my listeners. So we're going to have a lot of fun talking to Mr. Nickerson in just a few after the UFO news. I want to remind you before we get into the news, just real quick, because I'm just so excited about this, guys. And that, of course, is my Cosmic Exploration Conference. We have an incredible lineup of mainstream journalists, best-selling author Leslie Kane, who was on the show last week, and, of course, then some other scientists and PhDs and professors and ex-professors. And we've got Ben McGee, who's going to be on National Geographic. here on this UFO show, but he's the scientist guy, and he specializes in commercial space, so he's going to talk about the show in commercial space. We've got Ted Peters. He's a theologian. He's a professor, and he also works in science and writes about theology and science and has done a study on, are we going to freak out? Are the religions going to freak out if it's announced that there are extraterrestrial civilizations? He says no, and I have the study to prove it. And he's got some interesting facts as to what they are going to, or how people do feel about this in regards to their religion and worldview. So that's just a little bit of what's going on. And I think this is really great because I'm personally very excited in that I think it's important because what we're doing, what I'm doing is creating a space for scientists who are interested in this field. And there are. And some conventional scientists, I mean, Jeffrey Bennett, this is great. He's going to be talking about more conventional search for extraterrestrial life. He is also a PhD and an author and an astronomer and a physicist, astrophysics, how cool is that? Astrobiology is cool, but astrophysics and astrobiology mixed together, that's astronomical, astro-cool, if you ask me. So I'm very excited about Mr. Bennett and his talking about the more conventional side to the science. And this mixing together of all of this is where we should be. You know, we're introducing UFOs to the mainstream science dialogue, which is very important. And I think it's slowly moving that way, and we're just greasing those wheels. So be a part of it. It's going to be a lot of fun. I think this is going to be a historic event for our field. We're going to be moving this forward. And if you want to go to the dinner, there's plenty of seats. And I can always open up more seats when it comes to the lectures. But if you want to go to the dinner, then you're going to have to register as soon as possible. If you go and look at these other conferences going on, I've really kept the price down and as much as possible. Really, I'm not even getting as low as I could possibly go without losing my shorts. I don't have $10,000 to blow on this whole thing, although I gladly would if I had that kind of money, not to say that. And I've spent thousands of dollars of my own money already in this field. But the price is as low as it can be, and this dinner is going to be fun because the speakers will be there. And we'll be able to mingle and communicate and network and kind of create this community that can hopefully pierce the difficult shell of the conventional world in a serious manner. And I think we can do this, people. We can do this together. Come join us. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's Las Vegas. My goodness, right in the middle of the strip, so you can go party once you're done. Careful, you know, don't get too crazy. But of course there's a lot of fun. See a show, go walk the strip. I'm not a gambler or a drinker, but I love Vegas because I love just to walk the strip and look at all these cool things they have there. I mean, you don't have to spend a dime on shows. If you just walk up and down the strip, they have these giant waterfalls. They have all these different shows out on the street. All these different people, all this food, all of this glamour. It's just a very fun place. So certainly some people say their spouse, oh, my spouse doesn't want to come. What am I going to do? And you certainly have a lot of things for your spouse to do at this venue. So it's going to be great to see you there. Come up and say hi. And you can see a link to the site on UFODailyNews.com, which you're already going to on a regular basis. Thank you for that. Your patronage is much appreciated, but you'll see it at the top of the page. And also, if you go to cosmicex.com, or I got two URLs, cosmic-exploration.com. So I made sure we have lots of URLs for this baby. This is a two URL site. It took two domains here. You know, it wasn't enough for you people because you You guys deserve it. You deserve at least two, you know? Most everybody's got one. I'm like, come on. My people are better than that. They need two. Speaking of you all being deserving of the best, I, on a regular basis, collect the best UFO news in the mainstream headlines out there, and I bring that to you weekly, actually daily, practically hourly, if you're going to my site and looking at the feed or you're actually subscribed to the Twitter feed. So let's talk about this week. There's been a lot going on here. Holy cow, look at all these URLs I got here to go through. First, Huffington Post, and we talked about this earlier because actually my good buddy Jason McClellan, when he was helping us with the news, was talking about this, and now that it's actually started, that is the San Diego County Fair. If you live in beautiful San Diego, my goodness, what a beautiful place that is. It's not too far from me, actually, and I'm happy about that, and I've driven through, and I love the area. And that is the San Diego County Fair. What's so exciting about this? Not only is it just in a beautiful location, but much of the country is beautiful right now. It's summertime, baby, where it's burning hot out here in Arizona. Anyway, they are doing an extraterrestrial theme, extraterrestrial UFO theme, at the San Diego County Fair. How interesting is that? It's kind of perplexing in a way, though. And I'm not disparaging. This is wonderful that they're doing this. They have giant UFO models. They got ET stuff all over the place. They got a remake of the crashed Roswell UFO. A lot of cool stuff. But it doesn't look like they're really including people who research this topic. It would have been really neat if they would have had at least some people on this topic speaking. And I'm not just saying me. You know, they could have, I was going to say they could have called me. There's plenty of people they could have called. They could have called many of you. There's many people who are on the show that are great. I mean, there's plenty of researchers they could have had come and speak. And they didn't, really. So they're kind of doing their own thing. So that's kind of interesting. But hey, people are really excited. You know, in this Huffington Post article, they interview Ed McBride. He works with MUFON, so that's really exciting that they're kind of at least getting that kind of information out. Oh, and I'm sorry, I have the wrong name. It's Podell, Mel Podell of the MUFON out in that area, who they talked to and interviewed him. And he's real excited about it, of course. So, interesting. So, if you're in the San Diego area, you probably have already seen the commercials. You know, go to Facebook and tell us about it. That would be really cool if you go. The Daily Mail also did a story this week about Nick Pope. Of course, we've had Nick Pope on the show. He's a good friend. I've had him at plenty of the conferences I've had. In fact, when I organized the Roswell City conferences just a few years ago, I had him come to speak out there the first time, and that was his first time in Roswell, so I was great to be a part of that. Anyway, he worked for the Ministry of Defense at their UFO desk from 91 to 94, researching UFOs. He was a skeptic when he started. He was a believer when he left, and he's still talking about how we need to take this whole thing seriously. And they interviewed him, and they really kind of focused on one statement, and of course they're using it to, you know, get as much play on this story as they can, but essentially that he says, look for the sky at the Olympics, the UFOs may be there. Really, it's a whole conversation about how there's something going on, how there is a phenomena here that we need to pay attention to. They asked him about ETs. He said, well, you know, stuff like the Olympics would be a perfect place if they wanted to show themselves to the public, somewhere that's a big event where there are lots of people. So that's what he was talking about, and so they ran with that headline that Nick Pope says there's going to be UFOs at the Olympics. So he was just speculating, of course, that that would be kind of the place to be if they wanted to kind of show themselves. But it's great because he's such a credible person and that the Daily Mail has a story on him. This is kind of a space news story, but I mean, it's kind of a game changer as far as it comes to space, and it's kind of crept up on us. All of a sudden, there's stories about China launching astronauts, and it's not like, oh, China's got a plan to launch astronauts. It's like, no, this month, they're launching 3 astronauts into space to go connect with an orbiting experimental module. One of these might be a female astronaut. And so this is really exciting, I think. You know, their spacecraft is called the Shenzhou 9 spacecraft. And actually, you know, China's been open to this subject. In fact, there's a big modern organization out there and written about this and I think talked about it somewhat. But it was their government. Actually, Wendell Stevens was involved with this. But, they came to him later. But there were some people in China before, you know, during the Social Revolution, the academics were studying UFOs, but on the secret, because it was really shunned, and the Russians were advising the communists were advising China to stay away from this. So it was kind of done in secret. Once China became more independent, Shenzhou Li, I'm pretty sure that's how you say his name. His wife was working for the government, and they went to the government and said, hey, we want to study UFOs. We've got these professors and academics. And they said, hey, great. And they said, you need some help? We'll print your journal. And so they print the journal and got that, kind of got modern ufology out in China off the ground. So really interesting story. Why am I talking about that along with this program? Just with the idea that, of course, there are many who suspect that NASA is not sharing some of what they have found in space regarding extraterrestrials and UFOs. I don't know if that's true, but I think there is some compelling stuff that shows that at least there have been unknown craft that they have observed that they at least have been real quiet about, which certainly are deserving of a closer look. My point being that perhaps China will not be the same if they run across the same phenomena, and that perhaps they would be more willing to be forthright and kind of trump America to say, hey, you American goofballs, you haven't been paying attention, but look how cool we are, because we filmed some stuff and we've seen some stuff here, and we're going to make you look like a bunch of chumps because we're going to come out and say, hey, we're researching this and there's something really going on here. And so that's an interesting theory, I think. Talking about NASA possibly knowing something, there's another story in England by their paper The Sun. Of course, this is the one that has all the bikini girls and stuff like that. So if you're interested in bikini girls, then you're probably interested in The Sun, which is actually their biggest selling paper. It's a Rupert Murdoch production here. But they ran a story about a YouTube video, an American, a Yank, by the way, who posted a video. In fact, this guy's called the Californian, so he's in California. But he posted a video where he kind of took that Mars Google app and zoomed in and found this strange white anomaly that he says is a base of some sort. He speculates on the video, perhaps it's ET, perhaps it's NASA, perhaps it's secret. NASA probably doesn't know anything about this, so they need to look into it and this kind of thing. It is, I guess, I'd say an interesting video. It's hard to determine anything because it's the object itself, the area is not enough in a high enough resolution to really tell for sure what's going on here. But he feels confident that it does show a structure of some sort. He estimates it to be 700 feet long and 150 feet wide. Interesting. So hopefully more people will look into this and will find something out. SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Jill Tarter, who ran SETI, who is the inspiration for the movie Contact, and you know, the female lead in that excellent movie. If you haven't seen the movie Contact, you really need to check it out. It's a great movie. Anyway, they have a new boss, so a new guy taking over SETI. His name is Jeff Marcy, and they did a little Q&A with him on the sci-fi site IO9, which I talk about once in a while. You guys might be familiar with. They're a real kind of silly site. They have a lot of cool stories and some interesting stuff, though. It's more loose and laid back, that's for sure. But they asked him about, you know, why did you take this over? And he said, you know, he's just really interested to know if there are other intelligent beings out there. And if so, which he assumes there are, how close are they? You know, how close is our nearest neighbor? Something, of course, that we're all very interested in. He thinks it seems kind of crazy. That would be the only civilization. And people would really love to know if the galaxy is teeming with life, which sounds pretty likely. Now, he's working on a lot of these exoplanet projects, so he's wrapping that up. So he is looking for ET already, but more in the microbial realm. And now he will be looking for signals to find out if there are intelligent civilizations. So that's some interesting news. I thought you might like to know that SETI's got a new boss, and that's Seth Shostak, even though he's kind of their biggest spokesperson, is not the boss, nor is he now. What's going on with that? He is just a spokesperson and a great speaker, by the way, but that's what's going on with SETI. The Middle East, this is big news you may have heard of. In the Middle East, there were some UFOs seen over Israel, Syria, and other Middle Eastern countries. Some people were saying that, you know, this is an omen, good or bad, of course, depending on the side of the revolution, the kind of Syrian revolution that's going on right now, whichever side you were on. Omen for the side that is not the one you're on. So there's lots of speculation about this. I guess police got a lot of calls in Israel about this object, and it's very similar to some of the spiral type of things we've seen lately, although this one does match the time of a missile launched by Russia, and Russia is saying that this is certainly our missile, that once it hit its target, it spun out of control, and the fuel, you know, spinning the missile, which we've heard before, we've had on the show, the MUFON video analyst, who is also a specialist in space, and he talked about this with us, that these are definitely rockets that people are seeing. And so it's another case where it seems pretty solid that we can be sure this is a rocket, and the video looks very similar to the spirals that we've seen before. Although, as I pointed out in a story I wrote for Open Minds, that these spirals, mysterious spirals, have been seen in the East for a while, including a lot of them in China. Some of you are into that TV show Fact or Faked, the Paranormal Files, and we've had one of their stars, Ben Hansen, on the show. He's a good friend. He's a great guy. And he showed us this video that has made some news this week. He showed us at the UFO Congress, and he actually showed it to me and some friends prior. However, this is very strange lights in this wooded area that they filmed on one of their investigations. So it's like on the other side of this lake in a wooded area, you see these lights. Now, they're not flying up in the sky or anything. They're kind of flying at tree level and below, flying around in the woods. These really, really weird lights. So people are saying, hey, by definition, that's an unknown flying object. They're flying around these trees and stuff. So this is a mystery. I know Ben Hansen was really perplexed, and the whole crew don't know what the heck these lights are. So that's a really interesting one. Huffington Post here again is a group who covered that one. This is the westcountry.co.uk. So lots of these, it's kind of interesting. In the UK, Every area has a this is this, or this is that. This is New Hampshire. This is Worcestershire. This is, I'm not up to date completely on my English geography. I apologize to my English friends. I would love to visit England. It's beautiful. It's awesome. I love English people. I love English culture. I love English television. And I love English food in the way of pasties. Pasties are something else. But pasties, they're this yummy kind of food and comes from England with the bread around it kind of thing. Really good. So I love you UK people. So I do apologize for not being up on my geography out there. But this is Witheridge is the paper who wrote about this. And this is a lieutenant colonel who reported a UFO. He says his wife spotted what looked like a red planet in the western sky, but as there was considerable cloud cover, we wondered what it could be. The object then faded away, but after a few seconds, a larger object looking like a bright red flare appeared from the north. It looked as though it was at the end of an elliptical orbit as it turned and headed in the same direction as the first sighting, then fading away as before. This occurred three more times over a period of about 4 to 5 minutes. Very interesting sighting reported by This Is West Country. But this was a UFO over Witheridge. So, and I spared you my terrible English accent. So you should be very happy about that. Prometheus movie just started. I haven't seen it yet. I was going to see it this weekend. I got busy cleaning my house and working on these UFO things and everything, and I did not go see it. I'm very excited to, even though the most people have been like, eh, it's all right. I'm a big Aliens fan, big Ridley Scott fan, so I'm still going to go see it. And especially because, you know, in the Fox News covered this aspect again, that a big question from the movie is, did aliens create the human race? Well, interesting concept. Sounds like the ancient alien stuff, which we've talked about. Ridley Scott has already said was a major influence on this movie. The last story, it's UFO related because it's some unknown object flying around in the sky, and that's the X-37B, this secret space plane, which kind of looks like a mini space shuttle. It's this unmanned craft that has been in space for a year. This thing has been flying around for a flipping year up there. Nobody knows what it's for. Interesting enough, it just landed, and the Air Force has kind of made a big deal. They've released all these promo pictures and everything so you can see what it looks like, maybe showing off how cool they are. So this thing has been flying around for the year. They're just, oh, it's just a test vehicle. What? You're flying this test vehicle out around for a year? Come on. Give us a break. Nobody believes that. Even the conventional media is like, come on. Let us in on it. You're BSing us. You're pulling our leg. You're not being honest. You bunch of lions. Sons of you-know-whos. No, I'm sorry. I'm getting a little carried away here. But anyway, yeah, they're flying around this space plane. Who knows what they're doing? They're probably launching secret satellites, maybe capturing Russian satellites, and then, you know, the astronauts go in there and or no, there aren't any astronauts, so they just zap them and then let them go, or who knows what they're doing, these crazy guys. With our money, our tax dollars are doing all this stuff, but they can't build a regular shuttle. I don't know what's going on, people. I'm sorry. And on that note, we will move on to our interview with Randy Nickerson. Okay, I'm very happy to have on the telephone Randall Nickerson. Hello, Randall.
Hi, Alejandro. How are you?
Good, good. How are you doing?
I'm still here.
Keeping busy.
Yeah.
Well, great. I'm really excited to talk to you because this Ruah case is a great one, and it's wonderful to have someone going out there and getting some updates. And now, by trade, you're a photographer, is that correct?
Yeah, I would say photographer. I work in the film business, filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Also do some other things with pianos and music. And but yeah, freelance quite a bit.
So you do a lot of creative things.
Kind of on that side, yeah.
Yep. And it's just, you know, at the UFO Congress, you showed some of the clips, and the photography, you showed some of your pictures, which were incredible, and that's what's great. Your photography is so wonderful that it transitions to the video, so the shots are just so pretty. That's another reason why I'm really excited to see this movie.
Mm. Yeah, there is a lot of good, you know, I do the same thing with video that I do with stills. And, you know, it just takes a lot of time and patience to wait for the right shot, but it's worth it, usually. Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting it completed. It's been a long haul, almost a little over four years now since I started this project.
Wow.
And I'm fairly confident that it's going to leave an impression.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the story itself, it's just so much more interesting than I even thought in the beginning. It's been a journey.
What inspired you to do this documentary?
Since I heard about it. Back in 95, because I had known John Mack, and it wasn't until 2007 when I met with a friend of John's, Dominique, who was part of the John Mack Foundation, was part of the John Mack Foundation, and they asked if I would be interested in doing something with the footage. And I'd never looked at the footage carefully until then, and then, you know, I received all of the original footage and started going over it. And I was just struck by the consistency of these children reporting this and the numbers of them reporting it. And, the consistencies in their description and feeling. And when just looking at these kids telling this story, I just felt they're not lying. You know, there's some, you can tell when someone's telling the truth, and it's just the consistency just really blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of started the journey of even, you know, finding more material, which I did, tracking down any interviews of these children in the past, which I've discovered another 5 or 6 hours anyway of interviews of these kids back then, and even more kids that were, you know, the consistency is just pretty striking. So there's no question something very, very unusual happened at that school back in 1994.
Yeah, let's get into that then, because we'll talk more about John Mack, because of course he brought this to the public essentially. But, let's get into the case. So it's 1994, it's an elementary school, and I'll let you take it over from there, whereas these kids see this craft right in the outside the school.
Yes. 1994, September 16th, this was at a primary school in rural Zimbabwe, a town called Rua, and it's pretty rural out there. And these kids on morning break were out playing in the field, and they witnessed some type of silver craft come over. People had seen it in the sky beforehand, and then they saw it in the bush, maybe 100 or 150 yards away. And then they noticed two small beings get out of this craft, and one stayed with this silver object and the other came toward them. And pretty much that's the story. That's consistent throughout the interviews. And, you know, some kids were really excited about what happened. Some were really terrorized by it.
Now, did they see the craft leave also?
A few of them did. Something happened that scared the kids. I mean, it was a sound that the thing made, and a lot of them started running back toward the school. And I think I know there's a couple children that said that they did see it leave, but that wasn't something that was reported by the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few reported that.
And so then they run in and tell the teachers, but no teachers saw the craft, from what I understand.
That's not necessarily true. There was a teacher that was on the field that was reported by the students to have seen this thing. At least a few of the students. And, you know, I don't know for sure, but even some of the reporters on the scene said that the kids had told them that a teacher had witnessed this. Honestly, the teacher that was in question is no longer alive, unfortunately.
Mm.
But there was another teacher involved, who I did interview, that did not witness it that particular day, but did have an encounter within days of what happened on Ariel.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of there's a lot more new information.
Mm-hmm.
Some I can talk about, some I really can't get into until the film's completed.
Okay.
But there's a lot of new information.
Wow, interesting. So this area might be sort of a hot spot.
I would say so. I had written the U.S. Embassy in Zimbabwe to ask them about this particular incident, and I got an email back that said, yeah, that's probably true. Weird things happen here all the time from the State
Wow.
Department. Yeah, I thought that was kind of funny.
That is really funny.
But there are, you know, in Africa in general, I've been very interested in that particular continent because of, somewhat in the rural areas where there's just people don't know about them, about UFOs, so to speak. And there is still somewhat of a purity to their reports. And there is a lot happening over there that just the world just never knows, you know, finds out about it. And that, you know, another thing I had done, I've gone over several times and interviewed many other people regarding other incidents that have occurred over there. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't hear about it over here.
Mm-hmm.
But there's everything that happens, you know, globally that we've heard about it. I mean, literally every aspect of the phenomena occurs there as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, this area, just so people know, I'm sure a lot of people, but maybe not everybody, is familiar with this case, there were white and black children.
Yes.
And so it's a rural area. Are these guys farmers?
Yes. Okay. That was the primary business environment out there is farms. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And luckily, all the children speak English very well. Is that the main language of that country?
It's not the native language. The native language is Shona, primarily. But the white children were basically came over, I think it was back in the 1700s, from England, and so they're primarily, there's a lot, there's a, a lot of British influence, and it was a British colony for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe 1980 is when they gained their independence. But yeah, the children were very well educated. It's a very, very good primary school. And there was at that time quite a mix of Native children and the white farmers, basically children, which actually gave it kind of an interesting flavor, because you had two different, essentially, cultures discussing the same event.
Right.
Which I find interesting and helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of rules out some of the Western influence questions that can come up in this.
And that's what's interesting is what they describe. Now, how old were these children?
They range from about 8 to 13.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what I was thinking about, you know, as far as what you're talking about, this idea of Western influence, is because of the creature they describe. Now, I remember one little girl in her description, and I think a couple of the kids in the pictures, I mean, you can correct me, but it seems as though what they saw is very similar, what they described seeing and what the pictures they drew, similar to the gray type of creature that we're familiar with a big head and large almond kind of shaped eyes. Was that consistent?
I would say so. I would say pretty, seemed to be very consistent, except it was in black. I think some of the most interesting testimony, and part of this case that's very kind of threw me a curveball, which is actually fine, that one of the beings actually had long hair.
Oh.
Or what was interpreted by the children as long hair. Even John Mack, you know, had asked this question to the kids, and, you know, they had said, he'd asked, well, are you sure it was hair? And they weren't totally sure, but it looked like that. But the other one didn't have any at all. So there were two actually different types. And it's just, it was in the reporting that that came out. But the general size of the creature and the creatures and the anatomy were very similar to what they call a gray. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how long, do you get a sense of how long the encounter took place?
That ranges, you know, from their account. But I'm gathering from what I've gathered from the interviews back then in 94 and interviewing him today, I would say 10 to 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So it did occur, seemed to occur over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of the students ran to tell the teachers. Did they wait until later on, or did the teachers just not believe them? That's why they didn't come out to look?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true. The teachers didn't believe them at first, and they, you know, it was the children, actually, who really stood up for themselves, saying, you know, something did really happen. The teachers tried to you know, fog them off, as they would say, but it was the children who went home basically to their parents and told them that something really happened, and I think that's what really started a seriousness being taken about what occurred.
Mm-hmm. And now it seems, in hindsight, from what at least I've seen thus far, the teachers believe them. Is that true, or is there still some doubt?
I would say predominantly I would say at least, I mean, almost 100% of the teachers that I spoke with, I would say 90% believe the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, I went to find one specific teacher who at the time was interviewed, and he said he didn't believe the kids. And I found him, and I interviewed him and talked to him, and I asked him, well, what do you think today? And he said he believes them now because their story never changed, and that it was so consistent over time. Initially, he thought it was just kids being kids, but he said after time, the more time's gone by, more he was just impacted by the weight of the testimony, I guess, mm-hmm. of these kids and the consistency.
What one, especially there's this little girl that in particular that I think was. I always think about a lot in John Mack's interviews was that some of them seemed to have, even though this thing was only looking at them, they seemed to have like an impression about what these entities' thoughts were, as if there was a communication, although there wasn't any verbal communication.
That's somewhat true. I mean, mm-hmm. that definitely didn't occur with all the kids. But that it was definitely reported that there was some kind of brain-to-brain communication. Yeah.
And
mainly in pictures.
Okay. Oh, mainly in pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember this little girl describing, and you know, she seemed pretty young and very articulate in that she was describing that this thing was sad because we are destroying our planet and we're not taking good care of it, which
mm-hmm.
is an interesting thing for a kid to say. Is that kind of the similar message that some of the others who received messages got?
Yes. That was the consistent. Those that did have that experience, that was the message mm-hmm. that they, you know, got from that experience was, for some reason, about our planet. And it's funny because interviewing some of the people today, you know, the investigators that were on the scene, they're still struck by that because a lot of what they said as children back in 94 is really relevant today. You know, back in 94
right.
it wasn't a big deal so
mm-hmm.
much. Today it's pretty much in everybody's face.
How interesting, huh?
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. It is, yeah.
So John Mack, then he gets, or soon after he gets involved, and just for people, I'm pretty sure because I talked about John Mack, I'm a big fan of his, but John Mack, who worked at a professor at Harvard Medical School, a psychologist, he had won a Pulitzer Prize for a biography, actually,
mm-hmm.
and he took this alien abduction very seriously. He got involved due to Bud Hopkins. I was saying Bob, and I'm like, that's not right. Bud Hopkins. And he took a different perspective than Bud Hopkins, which is interesting. But then how did, you know, being someone who was involved with abduction, how did John Mack get involved with this case?
He was contacted by a journalist that was covering this case over there.
Mm-hmm.
And basically wanted Dr. Mack to look at this case. And it wasn't until about a month and a half before John Mack actually went and interviewed these children.
Mm-hmm.
But between that time, you know, between the time it occurred, September 16th, and when John arrived in December, a lot of other people had done interviews, and that is very interesting, the variety of interviews that were done by different camera crews, these children, which was part of the massive amount of information collected about this case.
Mm-hmm. So was it a bunch of news crews? I mean, was it a big news in the country?
Actually, it was on Reuters. It was on, let me see, okay. That particular case. BBC was covering it and Reuters were covering it initially.
Uh-huh.
But it was just like a blip on the radar and then it disappeared uh-huh. off the news. It was covered by several other smaller agencies in Africa, news agencies. And then had, you know, it been covered even after John Mack. The Dutch covered it, German, several other news agencies. It's been covered quite a bit in many ways by the news or documentaries, but on a small scale, you know, on a mm-hmm. not an in-depth investigation into it,
mm-hmm.
what occurred.
So did you know John Mack at that time yet?
Yes.
Oh, you did. So do you know how he felt? Did he feel, he seemed pretty open-minded, so he probably, I wouldn't sense that he would go in with a kind of a skeptical outlook, although he's a scientist, so he's probably looking for answers, but do you know what his mindset was going into it and how he felt once he talked to these children?
Well, I mean, the best judge of that is from the tapes. I think he went in pretty open-minded, and you know, I think he also really understood, like, kids are kids. He worked with children. Mm-hmm. That was one of his focuses in his career was working with children as a psychiatrist. So, you know, of all the interviews that were done, his interviews were actually revealed the most interesting information.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to draw out a lot from the kids, their emotions and thoughts and experiences that they had that the half a dozen or so other news organizations or people that interviewed the kids didn't get out of them. I think he was rather moved by it, I would say, by the whole experience.
That's what's great about these tapes and why they're gold and why I'm sure you're just, it's been a great experience to watch him because, like you said, I mean, he's the perfect guy to go do this, to go talk to these children. He's worked with children, and I mean, just, you know, his patience and the way the questions he asks, it's what I've been able to see of those interviews is great. I mean, he's able to, because it's his job, draw out from them to get clarity on what they experienced and how they felt. And it's incredible.
Yeah, that's true. And even, you know, when I just had his interviews, which are fantastic, that was one thing. But to actually see the interviews before and how they corroborate his interviews is, to me, even more striking. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, he was definitely the right person to interview these children as far as being able to find out more of what occurred. And he was, you know, people trust him. You know, people trust mm-hmm. him. Children, you know,
mm-hmm.
he was just had a demeanor about him that made you feel more open about sharing your experiences.
How did you first meet John Mack?
I met him in 92.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe. Let me see. Yeah, it was summer of 92. I think it was a conference in Boston.
How cool.
Yeah, I was very interested in his approach on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's one person that I really wish I would have met, but never, unfortunately, had the chance. So you were saying, along with his interviews and these other news interviews, the children were consistent in what they were saying.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty significant, especially for kids. I mean, if kids are making stuff up, especially a kid, they're going to add new stuff and add more kind of silly stuff. But that wasn't the case.
Now, you know, there are kids. That's kids do stuff like that. I'm sure mm-hmm. there may be a part of that, but the story on its entirety is consistent. About what they saw, and it's interesting too. You learn a lot when you interview people about human memory and how information comes forward. You know, some people see things that others don't see at the time, or recognize or remember specific things that others aren't concentrating at the time. But in that way, it creates its own story as a composition of everyone. And that's definitely true here. There are details that were brought forward by different, not all the children, but by enough of them to say that probably occurred.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Little small details, sounds, things that were
gotcha.
Small details that were witnessed that build a bigger picture of what occurred, which was part of the goal, which is to really get as much to find out what really happened there in as much entirety as possible, and then how it really affected people today and how they're living with it today.
Mm-hmm. So, Whit, could you describe maybe one of those things that came up? You know, a repeated theme that you know maybe no one else had picked up on that you were able to glean.
I think it was the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Really, that was one of them, but that was one particular. That there was a sound that was made from this craft or one of the beings. I'm actually not completely sure what it was, but it came from that direction that scared the children and made many of them run back toward the school at the time.
What was the sound like?
It was described like a flute, very high-pitched, cymbal tone. But,
really? That's
there's other details, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With the entities, they said they saw one stay at the craft, and then one moved away. Where did that one move to? Did it move towards them and then go back?
Yes.
Okay. And then, okay, and one of them, I can't remember if there was this was just a discrepancy that did some remember the one that stayed at the craft on top of the craft? Or
that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was
yeah.
on top.
Yeah, that was pretty consistently reported by most of the kids that there was one that was sitting on top of it while the other one came toward them. And there's actually two locations where this thing was seen. It wasn't just, you know, there were two landing sites where this thing was reportedly seen, the craft itself, which, you know, it's very interesting because the first site is much further away. And most of the kids saw that. The second site is much closer and would account for their ability to describe it in such detail.
Hmm.
Because the first site isn't, it's too far away, you know, too far away to really get the detail that some of these kids saw. But the second site, easily, they could have seen the detail of these beings.
How do you account for the two different sites?
You know, I'm not sure. I mean, it was over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it moved or if there were more than one. I really do not know that, but it was both sites were reported.
Okay.
And they're very specific locations that I had when I went there. I found had to find to see exactly where they reported seeing this thing and these beings.
So there's pretty much the original story. I mean, I think with John Mack, he went out and they videoed, and it. I know the footage got into a documentary. Well, now it's been in probably in several documentaries, but only a bit of the footage. I mean, I would guess we've probably only seen a small amount of what they videoed. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of it. Mm-hmm. I believe four or five hours of.
Oh wow.
On Max footage. You know, and Cynthia Hine, I got to say, I got to bring this up, because she really laid down the groundwork for the investigation. Unfortunately, she passed away in 2000. But she was the one first on the scene. She was there 4 days after. And her and her assistants really documented this event, and you know, I'm just really glad that they did, you know, mm-hmm. and also that John Mack did. But Cynthia Hine definitely, she was, I don't think, if it wasn't for her, I think it wouldn't have been publicized. I mean, events like this can disappear really quickly,
mm-hmm.
If nobody really takes it seriously and actually investigates it.
Mm-hmm. And she's a journalist?
She definitely had some experience in journalism. I honestly don't know her resume. Mm-hmm. But she, after her husband passed away, she became the MUFON director for Africa.
Oh, okay.
She was covering all kinds of events, and she wrote a couple books about encounters in Africa, and she did, you know, there's nobody that's really that did that work before or since to the degree that she did. It's unfortunate because there's a lot of stuff a lot of events going on in Africa that mm-hmm. don't make the mainstream.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because there's a lot of events going on in a lot of other countries, and
mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that we don't get you know, that out here so much. I mean, England we do, but I would say maybe that's the only other country, really, maybe Canada, that we get a lot of about what's going on.
It's funny because it's a very small percentage. The Western world's a very small percentage of the human population here.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to believe the natives more than I do Westerners in general about their encounters, because they don't, in general, they don't have a predisposition to the phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
So you get more of a raw experience of what they saw or what they encountered that was so odd. You know, and on this issue in general, I mean, I've been just moved by it, because there's no question something is happening worldwide that continues to happen. It's not, it hasn't gone away since the first reports, you know, in Western media in the 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And it even goes, as you know, way, way back in hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. But this isn't going to go away, this issue. It's going to continue to show up until we figure it out.
Right. Yeah, it's not, and that's a good thing. It's not going to go away. I mean, as frustrated as some investigators or people who research this get, because of maybe lack of attention in some cases, in many cases, it's not going anywhere. And
no.
That's something that we've always got. And more and more people then have experiences and come to understand that, hey, it may be crazy, it may not make sense, but it's here, and it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, and I think, and we had talked about it before, about this scientific community and, you know, there being more, I mean, when John Mack got involved, I think that was great, because it was bringing more of a scientific end to the challenge, you know,
mm-hmm.
Of trying to understand, well, what's actually occurring. And it just makes me think of Bud Hopkins when I talk to him. And I run into this a lot of times. More so recently, people say, well, an extraordinary, and they quote what Carl Sagan said, you know, an extraordinary claim demands extraordinary evidence. And as Bud Hopkins used to say, you know, yeah, an extraordinary claim demands an extraordinary investigation to get the extraordinary evidence, because the investigation part really has not been done to a level that is necessary. It's not, this is something elusive that's occurring. It's not something that's giving it all up front. There's definitely a sense from what I've got at looking at this that it's a there's something very covert about it. It's not something easy to catch.
Well, and like you're saying, I mean, even with this case, it's rare that all of the witnesses of an extraordinary case like this one are being able, are we able to interview them in depth and videotape those. I mean, it's a rarity to be able to do investigation to the level that was done with this case.
Sure. Yeah, that, it's definitely an unusual set of circumstances. I mean, I can look back on it now and say, well, boy, I wish they did this or interviewed this person. Or, you know. But they really did a good job considering the time and the technology and the fact that, you know, it's such a challenge, I think, to really get good information, because people are afraid of being ridiculed. And that's another big topic that I run into and think about. It's like, you know, we would, in general, on this topic, be a lot further ahead if people were not so afraid to come forward. In doing this film, I can't tell you how many people I've met who, you know, have come forward and said, well, this is what happened. You know, this is what we saw. And they'd never told anybody else about it. Because they're afraid of ridicule, or you know, it wasn't worth it to them to come forward because they were afraid that it would hurt them. You know, in some way that actually hurts the culture when people are afraid to tell what their experience is. You know, if that's a truthful thing, then it's important that the whole society know, or the whole civilization be aware of it, you know. So the whole ridicule question is also very disturbing, I think. And I think it really points out to a really greater fear that people have of actually looking at this, unfortunately.
Right. And it sounds like, you know, the teachers there kind of went through this, that the kids were so excited. They're reporting, hey, this incredible thing just happened. And, you know, I think we can all kind of probably sympathize a bit with the teachers kind of being like, what are you talking about? You know, kind of taken aback and probably not wanting to believe it until they finally did. I mean, how did the teachers describe that to you?
The a transition for them?
Right.
Yeah, well, the transition was around because it didn't stop. You know, the kids didn't stop talking about it, and they were insistent, really, because they really had to fight for the truth. In their, you know, I can't, the kids were... it was difficult for them. They had seen something, and they literally had to, not only were they, I think, stunned by what they saw, but they had to convince everybody else that that is actually what they saw, including their parents and the teachers, mainly. And so, yeah, I actually feel a lot for those kids, you know, at that time, because I think it was difficult. And I think, you know, again, what really made the teachers and most of the parents take it seriously was that the consistency. This was something that was consistently reported in detail by at least 64 kids, and many more saw, you know, other phenomena, but not to that detail.
The Native children, or at least the children in general there, you're referring to their kind of the Western influence. Did they have much of a Western influence? Did they watch a lot of our entertainment, for example? I mean, would they have been influenced in the description of the entities they saw by our media?
I think some of them. I know some of them had satellite television, but definitely not all of them. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely, there was technology there. It wasn't as up to date as we were in the States in 94. But it wasn't, you know, a complete rural village, even though there were, some of those kids were from rural villages.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the entirety, I can't say that for the entirety of the school. So there was something there, definitely. I mean, you know, the technology was there for media,
mm-hmm.
But not in the school. It was in certain students' homes.
Gotcha. And so you went to go interview some of these students also. Now that they're older, and I guess about how old were the kids now, and how many did you get to interview?
I believe 15 or 20. And then I spoke to probably 40 altogether on email.
Oh, wow. That's quite a bit.
Yeah, it was quite a bit. They're in their mid-20s, essentially, now. And, it took a little while to track them all down. They all remember that day,
mm-hmm.
very well, for the most part.
Are any of them doubtful in that, you know, just because this happens with sightings occasionally, people start to think, did I really see that? You know, they start to question themselves, partially because it's difficult to be someone to experience a phenomena like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, true. There definitely were a couple. Mm-hmm. Of kids that today who are questioning what they saw, but the significant amount, I mean, the most 90% of them anyway, pretty sure what they saw.
Wow. So and now they're more articulate. They're adults, young adults. Did you get then more description than they were able to offer as children?
In some cases, but not all. I'd say I got a more descriptive description of what they went through,
mm-hmm.
and their feelings and thoughts on the subject and what they saw that day.
And what were their feelings? There's probably a range of feelings, but how did they feel about what they experienced?
Well, I think they just, you know, it was just something that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think it sort of shocked them as a whole. I can't speak for all of them. That all of a sudden they found themselves in a position of having to defend themselves from people that didn't believe them. I guess the striking thing for me finding them all was that they'd never forgotten it. I mean, it was very, very fresh in their mind for the most part, and that how that time had affected their lives.
Wow. Was that kind of the I mean, the emotion of experiencing it, of course, is pretty shocking. But some of them, I mean, did they feel a very high level of frustration not being taken seriously?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even there were definitely people I ran into who didn't want to be interviewed because of, again, the ridicule factor or,
wow,
you know, and it's terrible. I mean, there's information being lost in those instances,
mm-hmm,
when people are not willing to come forward and speak about it because they're afraid of what other people are going to say. You're losing information. And the society's, you know, the civilization's losing information that's actually valuable.
Mm-hmm.
To figure out what you know, what's occurring in these events.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, definitely people, a few that I ran into were very reluctant to speak.
Yeah. Like you said, yeah, that it's really sad, and hopefully they'll come forward later on. But it can be, I think anybody can understand the difficulty for these guys because, as you know, and I know, I mean, even once, for instance, you tell people you're working on something like this, you know, then mm-hmm. it becomes a topic, and in some cases, ridicule or being looked at funny or you, it's not always easy.
No.
With these guys, now that they're older and they're able to articulate it more, these messages in the form of pictures, were you able to get more information about that aspect?
Not specifically about it. I think the main information was recovered back then in
mm-hmm.
94. Yeah, I, you know, just feelings about that. I think the relevancy of it today came up.
What do you think about that? Because that's been an ongoing kind of message, and if you're familiar with Bud Hopkins' work or John Mack's work or other who work with people who, or Dr. Sprinkle, another psychologist who actually has done a mm-hmm. lot of more inventories behind this, a constant message of, you know, you're messing up your planet, you got to fix it. And don't you think, yeah, like we talked about earlier, it's interesting that message has finally gotten into our subconscious. Do you think there's a relationship?
Between?
These third parties, this seemingly third party coming in and telling us this, and here 10, 20 years later,
right,
us beginning to take this message serious.
Yeah, I honestly don't know, but I find it very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know, but there's been enough reports and in a lot of the research to consistent reoccurrence. That in some way like a big brother, kind of, you know, not big brother, but
mm-hmm.
You know, there's messages being sent one way or another, and I'm not sure. But I do find it interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, mentioned earlier, like John Mack and Bud Hopkins, and I think, you know, I knew both of them very well, and I know that in this, people categorize as John positive and Bud negative about it. But really, I never saw that much of a difference in the way they looked at this subject. I mean, they both, what I found really the most powerful thing was they both took it seriously. And neither one really had the answers, but they were just recording data. And, you know, I've sometimes run into people and, you know, they talk about it in a positive or negative aspect, you know, like it's a positive thing or whatever. It's not that. If anything, you know, that I've seen anyway, it's both. You know, you look at nature, you look at different aspects of anything, you're going to have both sides. It's just part of the duality of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I just wanted to say that because I know Bud had felt like people had categorized him into sort of a negative category around this issue, and he wasn't really negative. He just, you know, he was looking at the data that he had, and I think that, you know, in a lot of ways, John also agreed with a lot of the data that Butt had. And I don't know, there's just I think we lose something when we try to categorize things into one way or another instead of looking at it as in an all-encompassing perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a really good point you make, because neither of these guys are going and pounding the drum of, you know, positive or negative. They're doing their work and they're gathering data. But these labels are imposed upon them by people, and it's interesting how people just need to categorize things like that. But like you're saying, these are labels that are imposed, not ones that they're seeking. They're just gathering data and getting that information across.
Yeah, and if you consider only one set of data valuable, you're missing a lot of information.
Mm-hmm.
That could be relevant.
Yeah, it's another unfortunate way we lose data is thinking, oh, you know, this fits my worldview. I like this, so I'm only going to look at this.
It doesn't exist. I mean, what really strikes me is, you know, I spend an awful lot of time in nature photographing wildlife and spending a lot of time with wildlife. You know, some of the most beautiful experiences and beautiful sights you see are profound. But if you wait long enough, you'll see the other side. And, you know, and that's just part of it. You know, some of a creature that you might think is the most gentle, amazing creature in the world, and you see it kill something else, which happens all the time, you can't discount that. It's real.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of that creature's makeup. You know, that's just nature. It's harsh and beautiful at the same time, and you definitely see that particularly strongly in Africa.
I'm chuckling because it just makes me think of my little dog here, because I'm a vegetarian, but she's not. She's a carnivorous, and she's a cute little chihuahua, but she will go kill and hunt for her food.
Yeah.
It's a great point. And it's the nature of things. And I think you're right. We can't ever just kind of label and say everything's good, everything's bad. We hamper ourselves when we do so.
Yeah, because I haven't met anybody that really has all the answers on this particular topic. And,
right.
So I think we, as a human being, really need to be take into account all the reports and information and figure it out. We can figure it out. We're not trying hard enough, I believe.
Yeah.
For various reasons. But
agreed.
I do believe that we do have the capability of figuring out.
A couple more questions. On the children, real quick, did any of them, let these messages, did they guide their lives? I mean, in other words, did you find that some of them are working in environmental, getting degrees that way to actually try to heed those warnings? Did it have an influence on them that way?
Not entirely. Mm-hmm. What I was very impressed with was that they're rather successful kids, for the most part.
They seemed intelligent. I mean,
in politics and different aspects, they're very intelligent kids. And I would not say particularly in ecology, right? Is that the right word?
Uh huh.
But I, from knowing these kids today, I would definitely say that they have a really good perspective about what's going on in the world and ecologically and with pollution and stuff like that. They're very aware.
Mm-hmm.
How that is going to play out. I mean, I am very interested to see when this film is released, who it will bring forward because I would like to, there are still people out there involved in this, that were involved in this incident that I have not been able to find. Hmm. And I'm very interested to speak with people further down the road. Because, you know, people evolve. I mean, these kids, these guys, they're only in their mid-20s. And I'm interested to see what these kids do in their 30s and 40s. And sort of keep an eye on them. But in general, I mean, I really feel like they're, a lot of these really wonderful kids.
Mm-hmm.
Honest, you know, pretty pure and honest kids in general.
How close are you to having the movie ready?
I'm still a few months away for sure.
Okay.
But I'm plugging away.
Cool.
Every day and every night. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of footage to go through. And
yeah, and they have it under the project section, current projects, on the John E. Mack Institute website. But what do you think? What are your, I guess, overall impressions of what happened? I don't know if you probably ask yourself these questions, but who landed and for what reasons?
Good question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not entirely sure what the reasons were. I mean, there's a lot of thought, and the kids thought about this a lot, wondering what the purpose was, whether they had some kind of mechanical issue, or it was specifically designed for them to interact with these kids at this time. I'm definitely going to get into those theories in the film because the kids brought them up. They were wondering, why did this occur? Why did this occur at this time? You know, there's a lot of other things that were going on at that time. That was in South Africa, right across the border. They were going through, it was the end of apartheid. Mandela was elected. I mean, it was a very big change in the political turf, I mean, in that area. There was a lot of interesting stuff going on at that time, interesting things.
So it's still just that often happens in this. The more we learn, it's still just as mysterious as it was before we started. A lot more data, but a lot more data is needed, I guess, before we can really reach answers.
Yeah, there are big holes that. Need answering. But, people, I guess, there's been progress made over the decades, slowly but surely.
Mm-hmm. What is your goal then?
Exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm. What is kind of your view as putting forth this movie? What do you hope, or the documentary, what do you hope people get from it?
I hope it opens people's minds a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a species, we really need to be aware of the potential and possibilities of other life out there. I mean, it's just it's just a matter of time before we know it from an astronomical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
When we're already finding these planets orbiting around other suns, and it's just a matter of time before we're going to nail life and say, okay, there is other life, and then it'll get to the conversation of more intelligent life. But I think we really need, the responsible thing as a species is to be aware of a potential threat. I mean, not necessarily. It doesn't necessarily have to be a threat, but the possibility of something else out there. It's just wise. It's not. I don't think it's a good approach to look out there and immediately say nothing's out there. Nothing more intelligent than us is out there. I think that's just not a good approach.
Yeah, burying our heads is about the situation. Facing it is not a good answer.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be bad,
mm-hmm.
but it could be.
Right.
And you know, if we're not aware, then it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Because whatever's going to occur is going to occur. You know, I definitely think of it on a wildlife perspective, you know, of that same thing. Yeah, you have to be aware of what else is out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're about out of time, but thank you so much for joining me today.
And yeah, I really appreciate talking with you.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's an interesting case. And thank you so much for doing this. I mean, I think what you're doing is really important. I think John Mack's work was important. This case is so incredibly interesting. I can't say how excited I am that you've picked up this project and you're doing this. And it was a lot of fun, and it was really great meeting you also at the UFO Congress.
Yeah, that was an experience. I hadn't spoken in public for a long time. I was very nervous, but yeah, it's been a lot of work. I can't even tell you how much work has gone into this project.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be good when it's done, and hopefully it'll move the conversation forward somehow. And
I think it will.
I hope so. I think it will too, actually. Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Alejandro.
Okay, that's Mr. Randy Nickerson. And so, yeah, how exciting is this documentary he's working on? This is going to be great, you know. And like I said, I got to see a little bit, and the interviews are great with the kids who are 20-something, and his filmography is great, really good, because the camera work, because he's got a great eye for photography, so it's really pretty. So I'm really excited for this documentary. You can go to John E. Mack's site. It's the John Mack Foundation. And if you click on projects, you'll see more about this project. And hopefully you'll see some updates there. Otherwise, I will certainly be keeping you up to date. And hopefully we'll see this project finished by year's end. Thank you all so much for joining me again today. It's been a lot of fun. Be sure to check out UFOThinkTank.com, or that's just going to redirect you actually to UFODailyNews.com. That's UFODailyNews.com for the latest in UFO news updates and everything going down. You can check the news feed. I haven't written a lot of stories this past week because I've been busy at work and I've got this conference to work on. So go to the link, register for the conference fast so you get yourself a seat at the dinner. And join us next week. We'll have another exciting show. And again, thank you too, and enjoy the closing music by Two Earth Minutes. Talk to you later, people. Okay, I'm very happy to have on the telephone Randy. That was the wrong button. I do apologize.